Welcome to the Sean Chandler Podcast, a place to talk movies and nerd culture way too much. Joining me today is Griffin Schiller. How you doing, man?
Hey, how's it going, dude? It's kind of weird to get back to just the two of us doing that. I've been so used to a third guest being, or like a third person being on the show for the past couple of weeks. So, I feel like this one's just going to be a lot more relaxed. There's no expectations this time around. We don't have to put on a podcast kind of front or whatever. It'll just be
just us
doing our thing,
talking movies. Absolutely. And of course, since the last one we recorded, we got some big gigantic news, which will be a big part of the show, but you were supposed to come to town this week.
Yeah.
And then, you know, pandemics kind of caused problems. So that won't be happening
true.
Now.
Yeah, and I'm currently in a battle with American Airlines to get my flight refunded, because apparently they're the only airline who's refusing to refund people, even though the mayor of Austin, Texas, was the one who canceled the festival because he was taking precautionary measures for his city.
So if you don't know the background on this, Griffin was supposed to come to town for South by Southwest, the film festival. We actually had an Airbnb booked. Zach Pope was going to be there too. Had this whole big gigantic plan, and then the mayor of Austin called off South by Southwest last week, which is a huge thing. I mean, that's massive for the economy of Austin. Huge ramifications for the film industry, music industry, tech industry. But we'll get to that later on. But on the small version, just for us, is the weird week that we've had. So then we've been dealing with the ramifications of this big thing we were planning for isn't actually going to happen. So
all the videos we're gonna record are gonna have to be done the old-fashioned way, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had four videos planned for us to shoot next week, and then none of them happening now, or delayed, or we have to do this whole Skype thing after all. All right, real quick, before we go into all of this, if you're listening to the audio version, be sure on whatever platform you're on to be able to leave a rating, a review, all that fun stuff. It helps the podcast to rank better, especially early on where we're trying to get some momentum, get some people to discover the show in these early phases. Anything you can do to subscribe, follow, download, listen, rate it, review it, helps out to build that momentum, and it's greatly appreciated. Today, we're going to be talking about the new Black Widow trailer that dropped. We're going to talk about the images of the Batmobile that dropped. Brandon Routh appeared on Michael Rosenbaum's podcast, said some interesting stuff that we thought we would talk through just a little bit. Then we're looking at the effects of the coronavirus on the film industry, where a major film was delayed, a Bond film pushed back a month out from release back to November, as well as South by Southwest getting canceled. And then, because we had a new Pixar movie this weekend, we'll be talking a little bit about Pixar, what we love about them, what frustrates us when Pixar does certain things, and we'll give you our Pixar recommendations, and maybe we'll talk about a few other things thrown in the mix as we go through all of this. With that said, let's go ahead and get started. Earlier today, I woke up, first time I checked Twitter, realized 45 minutes earlier a Black Widow trailer had dropped, and so I ran upstairs to shoot a trailer reaction. And Griffin, what did you think about the final Black Widow trailer?
Yeah, well, they dropped that puppy real early. It was like 5 a.m. Pacific time, which is like usually they wait until like at least 6, but like, man, they weren't waiting for that one. I loved it. I've been pretty vocal about the fact that I am very excited for this film. Ever since I saw the first footage at San Comic-Con last year, and like what they're kind of doing with the property and everything, I have been all in, and this trailer just doubles down on everything that I'm excited for about this movie. The action looks amazing, probably some of the best hand-to-hand combat that I've seen outside of the Winter Soldier in a Marvel film, so like that gets me very excited. I love the espionage thing. It looks like a bunch of like Black Widow assassins are kind of like after her, and I can't wait to see what happens there. I love David Harbour as Red Guardian. Taskmaster looks so cool. I think he's going to be a really he or she, depending if you're believing the theories that Rachel Weisz might actually be Taskmaster, which I'm kind of leaning towards. But I'm really excited for Taskmaster because I think they're going to set him up to be someone that's reoccurring down the line. I don't think we're going to see the end of Taskmaster in this film. Some people have speculated that he's going to tie into Falcon in the Winter Soldier. He's going to be the one training U.S. agent, which is Wyatt Russell's character on like the Captain America, and so that'll tie in with the Falcon and Winter Soldier trying to fight him, along with Baron Zemo. So who knows? But going back to Black Widow, Florence Pugh looks incredible. I like the family dynamic, and I just like all the shots and like the action set pieces feel grounded, but like not too grounded. It's grounded just enough for me to believe that it could happen in reality, but they do take liberties. So I'm all in on this, man. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah. So for me, I enjoyed that we're getting another spy movie in the MCU, and even more so this one. Even it's like full blown. I mean, where Winter Soldier was kind of this espionage political thriller, this one is just all out spy movie. Certainly, both visually and plot wise, you can feel some Bourne stuff in the mix.
Yeah, majorly.
Those shots where Florence Pugh and Scarlett are in the apartment, and then they're on motorcycles and in the car chasing, feels straight out of a Bourne movie. I love that we're getting good hand to hand combat. And just some real cool shots. I love that kind of thing. And so this is a property that makes sense to do that with it and not just have everything be big, gigantic spectacle. Even just the setup of what we're learning of Taskmaster and learning the skills, and they're slowly releasing that. And so even as I first watched this one, the trailer, I didn't pick up on, oh, those were Black Panther claws that he's shooting at his hands. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as I post mine, people are like, those are Black Panther claws. I was like, oh, that makes a lot more sense as to what I just saw. And it's just a lot of stuff like that that makes a more interesting villain. My criticism that I mentioned in my trailer reaction, and not necessarily criticism, but fear, is that because it's a prequel of sorts, it's set where we've already passed in the timeline, the trailers to average Joe make it feel somewhat inconsequential to the MCU. It's like, it feels like she already died. Okay, looks like a cool, fun movie. I'll just wait for Disney Plus. It doesn't have that urgency to it, whereas like Infinity War, Endgame, especially with Endgame, it was like you felt like if you didn't see it that weekend, you're missing the world. Now, of course, that's a pinnacle film for a gigantic franchise, but this one, but even Spider-Man Far From Home had this sense of like, oh, what are we going to find out about what happened after Endgame? And there was something about it that made you go, I got to go see it now. Whereas this one, the trailers don't really give a hint as to what that is. So it's just like a movie that's out there.
Yeah, I kind of get that. At the same time, I think people are just going to be excited for a Black Widow movie. You can say all day long, oh, this should have happened five or 10 years ago. Like, yes, it should have. But you know what? It's happening now, and while we ultimately know the fate of Black Widow, we don't know the fate of, you know, Florence Pugh's character, David Harbour's character, and, you know, there's, like, other characters in this film that I'm sure we'll get to know and love, and we'll be concerned about what happens to them. I have a feeling that this is going to be a case, especially for me personally. I have a feeling it's going to be kind of like the Ant-Man movies, not necessarily in terms of tone or stakes or whatnot, but just in terms of, it's not like the most important to watch if you want to get a sense of the overall timeline of the MCU, but it's going to be a little more, it's going to be more self-contained. It's going to focus on the characters, developing them into, you know, more fully realized people. And I think it's going to paint an I think it's going to serve in painting a pretty accurate portrait of who Black Widow is when we find her Infinity War. There's a few things that I've picked up on, which is the vest that Florence Pugh's character is wearing in the film is the same vest that Natasha is wearing in Infinity War. Does that mean Florence Pugh dies at the end of Black Widow? I don't know, but seeing their relationship and how close they are, it definitely will help flesh out, Natasha in that like window of time where we don't see them before Infinity War.
Yeah. Well, the one that has me most interested is all the shots of Thunderbolt Ross. He looks de-aged significantly.
Yeah.
And so whatever we're seeing seems like we're going back 15 years. Probably looks like potentially pre-Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of time jumps in this one. We're definitely going to get some stuff like pre-MCU back when she was probably in training and whatnot. We'll get some of her backstory fleshed out because we really haven't gotten a whole lot. Then we'll probably get some, like, where, because, you know, Taskmaster's watching that video of, like, Black Widow fighting in Iron Man 2, so we'll probably get some of that in that time period, and then, obviously, back, you know, the film is taking place in between Civil War and Infinity War, so definitely in that time period. I don't know, man, I think this movie poses an interesting opportunity to just fill in the blanks with some important character information that makes her sacrifice at the end of Endgame even more powerful than it already is.
Yeah, I think what I love about the MCU, as much as people talk about the formula and they all feel the same, there's a lot of variety in there. They do a lot of different things. And when you have 23, now 24 movies, you'll have some that are like, okay, these are too similar. But they do a bunch of different things, and they do things that allow you to kind of dive into what started in Iron Man 2 as side character with very few lines of dialogue. And now here we are 10 years later, and she has her own movie. And then, you know, Thunderbolt Ross, who's antagonistic in a movie 12 years ago, makes a couple of side appearances, and now he appears again. I just love that there is such a fleshed out world in history that we're getting with all of this. All right, from there, let's move on over to second subject of the day. We got some new pictures of first pictures of the Batmobile. Matt Reeves tweeted out three different pictures of the new Batmobile. One of them is kind of head on, you can see Batman standing next to it. Another one's kind of from the side. You see Batman next to it. And one of them is kind of like a close-up of the back of the Batmobile. And it has kind of this, it's like 60s American muscle look to the Batmobile. What did you think about it?
Hey, listen, Pattinson loves his muscle cars. That's what I'm taking away from it. I love how unassuming it is. Like, it just... it feels, whereas, like, you know, the Burton and Schumacher Batmobiles were more, like, stylized, like, gothic, harkening back to, like, you know, the comics and stuff like that. And then, like, the one in the Tumbler in the Nolan films was, like, a tank basically made for war. Yeah. Definitely fit where that Batman was.
Batman v Superman was likewise kind of a tank.
Yeah, it was like a hybrid of the Burton and the Nolan Batmobiles. Whereas, like, this one is just full on. It's more interested in functionality than it is, like, looking impressive. And it just, like, I got like shades of Knight Rider in there. I don't know if you did, but, like, I think, especially if this film is taking place in the 80s or 90s, like, or late 80s, early 90s, that's like so smart for Matt Reeves to do, playing into that whole, like, you know, the Knight Rider kind of thing. I think that's an interesting kind of take on the Batmobile. But yeah, I really like just how, like, functional it is. Like, this is a Batman, clearly you can tell by the Batmobile, you can tell that this is a Batman who is actually chasing down criminals. Like, he is concerned carrying out like justice to these guys instead of just, like, you know, plowing through them or just looking cool in the streets, which really adds to the whole, like, grunge sort of punk aesthetic I keep bringing up every time we get new stuff from this. I actually really like it, and I think it's weird because I, you know, you just say, oh, he's driving a Mustang, like, that sounds weird, but in an execution, they made it work.
Yeah, I've always kind of had problems with the Nolan Batmobile. I think there's an inherent flaw of doing something so grounded, and then Batman is driving around this highly advanced piece of military hardware, and none of the designers went, wait a minute, I've got the designs for that right over here. There's only so many people that could grab that. There's some stuff like, and it, likewise, you have this military piece of hardware that he's just driving down the street in the middle of the, you know, through town. Immediately, it just calls into so many questions, so many things that feel out of place for an otherwise more grounded take on the character. And then, you know, the Burton design, Schumacher, those were very stylized movies that weren't attempting to be grounded. So they fit those films.
Yeah, they definitely
did. And so then with what it seems like they're doing with this film that is feeling maybe a little bit more Nolan, but more bigger universe, bigger rogues gallery, the idea that it's this design that he just kind of made with a mechanic somewhere. Seems to make sense to me. One of my one of the fun every episode of Batman the Animated Series is pretty great. But so one of them that I remember was called The Mechanic, and the Batmobile like gets broken in a chase, and so he has to go to his mechanic, and because of this people figure out where the mechanic is at, and so Batman has to help his mechanic. And it's like for a children's show, because it came out like 30 years ago. It's supposed to be, I was like the perfect age as like a fifth grader, sixth grader when it came out. But it's like such a realistic type of plot line of how would someone try and catch Batman? They figure out where he takes his broken car to and stuff like that. But the idea was, it was just this guy that he's working with on a car as opposed to this whole team of engineers to design his bat tank thing. And I like that. I like it when it feels like something where I can kind of play out how this happened and where it came from, as opposed to like, he just magically has super stylized car. I was really digging it. The look of it, everything kind of works for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think just, taking it a step further, it's really just like, it really is doubling down on that like street level approach to grounding this Batman. Like, this is a guy who like lives his nights on the streets hunting down criminals. Like, his armor emphasizes protection. His Batmobile is primed to run down criminals. And like, I feel like it's an indication of like the type of story that Matt Reeves is telling. You know, definitely going into more of that psychological examination of Bruce Wayne as a person. And so, like, all of this is really pointing towards that. And I love that. It feels familiar while, incredibly different from anything we've gotten before.
And two, what we kind of been it seems like every week we're talking about new stuff coming out. And I think I'm just really enjoying that they're being pretty open with things. And they're slowly releasing it. And it's not like it seemed like there was a few years there where every time we'd get the first look at a movie, it would be like one of these Entertainment Weekly shoots. They were horribly photoshopped. Everything was like super bright. And so you'd see these people in these comic book costumes, super bright, and it just looked ridiculous. And I love that it's the director being like, all right, this is the shot right here. I mean, it's what he wants with a lot of it. And so and it gives us lots of content to talk about here on the podcast.
Yeah, that's true.
Makes it nice and easy to have something fun to talk about. All right, let's move on to something else that's a little bit different. But so Brandon Routh appeared on Michael Rosenbaum's podcast, Inside of You. So Michael Rosenbaum's had a podcast for a couple years now. He was Lex Luthor on Smallville. And what's funny is that people think that he's like the character Lex Luthor, who's super serious, this brooding character. Michael Rosenbaum, the person, is like high energy, hyperactive, funny, totally different personalities.
So awesome. And, yeah, really just nice guy.
And so it's interesting because you go, oh, wow, he's a really good actor, because he's nothing like that version of Lex Luthor. So he started this podcast, and basically he has his celebrity friends on. So he's had James Gunn on. He's had Dave Bautista, Stephen Amell, Tom Welling's on there pretty regularly. Those ones are always a lot of fun, especially if you're like an old school Smallville person. And what he does so well is he gets people to be vulnerable, and they talk about things they don't normally talk about in interviews, and they open up in ways that's unusual. And one more thing before we dive into the specific one, he's actually doing a show here in Austin in a couple of weeks with Zachary Levi, and my wife and I actually already have tickets to go see it, so we're pretty pumped actually to check that out. But so Brandon Routh was on the show, and this one was interesting because it touched, as they always do, on they take these people that we view as like TV stars and movie stars, and they talk like normal humans. Yeah. And that's what it does so well. Like Stephen Amell, the one that he was on a month ago, had to be recorded in two batches because he had a nervous breakdown in the middle of the first one. And basically Stephen Amell was like, no, let's run with that. We could still use that. Like, I don't want to cut anything. Let's just go ahead with it. I'll come back and we'll finish it. But people need to see that sort of thing. And so Brandon Routh came on and was just really open about Superman Returns, leaving Legends of Tomorrow, and just his own anxieties and things that he's kind of been like as a movie star guy and TV star guy thinking through his career. What you listened to it. What were the things that stuck out to you?
Yeah. The thing that stuck out, because I really felt had fallen off the whole Arrowverse thing. So, like, I wasn't aware of, like, what went down. I mean, I knew that Oliver Queen, spoiler alert, died in the show. And I know Stephen Amell wasn't a fan of how they handled that death. And I guess there's
which is also something that came out on the Michael Rosenbaum podcast.
Yep, like, exactly.
Like, he was sitting there and he started like, the way that they shot my death scene was like they were trying to rush it to get rid of these two actors, and they were going to put some tennis balls up, and Zorro was going to die staring at a tennis ball. And like, once again, something that came out on the Michael Rosenbaum podcast, which is interesting that that's becoming in the year 2020.
Yeah.
A recurring pattern that he's getting really interesting stuff that is worth us talking about. Sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, no, but I think it is interesting because it's just like it really shows you it kind of points to a larger issue which has kind of been why I fought the Arrowverse thing. They just don't they don't really know what they're doing with it anymore. it's become too big, too convoluted, too just stupid in a way, and I think even the actors know it, and they're disappointed with how things have kind of wrapped up and concluded. Brandon Routh was like written out of the show, and while they told him at the beginning of the season, it did kind of blindside him, and I didn't realize that was the case. And I guess they're replacing his character with like someone else, or like someone else is taking up the Adam mantle. I don't know if that's true or not. That's just kind of what I got from listening, because I don't really watch the show anymore. But the other thing that the big takeaway for me from that conversation was, I guess the whole Bryan Singer thing about, you know, kind of doubling down on the fact that he's a terrible person and was a terrible person on the set of Superman Returns, which is interesting. But the other big thing, you know, when they were kind of talking about what happened with Brandon Routh and whatnot, and him having to like focus more on his family and stuff, they were talking about like disconnecting from you know, like emails, society, online, Twitter and whatnot, and like how we're sort of on this like autopilot. We're not inherently born with it, but we kind of like learn it as, you know, brought up in this, you know, 21st century modern society where phones are literally given to you at the age of 5. So like they were kind of talking about that and like the need to urgently like to an email or a text message or to constantly be online and checking things and how that can interfere with like your daily lives. Like, you know, you'll be out with I don't have any kids, but if I had kids, you'll be out with your kid or whatnot. And like just finding the time to surrender to the moment and be present as opposed to, you know, constantly being on top of things on your phone. And I think that was something that really resonated with me, because that's something that I consistently struggle with, is just being present in the moment.
Yeah.
And I was actually curious about what your kind of take on this was, having kids. Like, do you find yourself struggling in those moments to like be present? Or is it easy for you?
So, my wife and I have kind of going into 2020 set things in place, in motion, for the sole purpose of making sure that we're scheduling time every week to be present.
Yeah.
Because both of us work from home and both of us work like technology type stuff, internet stuff. So for me, there's always another comment to reply to. There's always another direct message on Instagram I can reply to. There's always a person to schedule. I always need to be on top of what movie news to talk about and everything. There's always a new tweet to send out. And my wife does like helps with social media for a company. It does supports the local franchises for the whole state of Texas. And so there's like 130 franchises that count on her for her wisdom, and they might message her at any point in time. So both of us have this issue of constantly having our phones out, constantly having our computer. And then during the day, we're just used to computers in front of me, phones in front of me, just responding to stuff. Yeah. And then our kids get home and we're just still kind of doing that. That's just our routine. And so we're very aware of the fact that we got to fix that, or we need to have breaks from it. Because, you know, that's some of that's just, you can't deny the reality of the 21st century. But you also don't want to make that an excuse. So we're doing family fun nights. And so we've done 8 of them thus far this year, where we lock our phones somewhere and then basically have a bunch of fun activities we put in a hat and the kids draw it out. And then it's like five different things. Do we leave the house? Do we go to a restaurant? Do we play a board game? And then from that one, we have a second hat where they draw which specific activity. And so even yesterday, we were out and about. Part of what we were doing was for yesterday's family fun night was getting – Chloe's getting her ears pierced. I don't know – like got her ears pierced for the first time. Went to downtown Austin, the UT campus. Went to a tattoo parlor. Walked in. It looked like someone was having surgery downstairs. She's having the massive tattoo, blood or paint or whatever it was everywhere. We're like, kids, look over here. Look at the wall. There's like naked ladies painted on the walls. Yeah. Walk upstairs. And then like these two people, like gauges, tons of tattoos, two nicest people you'll ever meet. Like just, they were so good with her. She gets her ears pierced and we're driving back. And I realized on this this whole family excursion, I'm on my phone doing direct messages with someone. And it was even something that was like, the guy was like, I don't know. There's a little bit of tension inside of it. So my mind was very much non-present with my family on this family adventure. Doing something like she's going to remember getting her ears pierced forever. Like girls, you know, that's what those good girls remember. And there's images to it of tattoo parlor. And I'm on my phone talking with some guy on Instagram over DMs.
Yeah.
And I'm going, man.
No, I struggle with the same thing. You're right, because there's just this innate sense of urgency. Like it's almost like an impulse. Like because especially when you get into like arguments online, and like I notice that when I get into arguments online with people, I get like heated, like instantly. Yeah. I feel my body just completely change its composure. And it's bad. It's really bad. And like there are times I just have to sit back and I'm just like, what. What are you doing right now? Like the amount of time and energy you're putting into this discussion or disagreement, it's like, is that worth sacrificing whatever you're doing in the present moment? You know, like, and it's a struggle because, you know, just like being in this space and living the life of where you have to be online all the time in order to like engage with fans, in order to like, you know, boost your presence and whatnot, you do end up kind of falling victim to not taking part in like the most important things in life. And so like there are several times where like, you know, I'll be out on the pier with my girlfriend, right? And we're looking at this beautiful sunset and I'm like concerned about like responding to an email about a screening. And like with me, I have to respond like right that second. I hate putting things off. And so it just becomes a real problem. There's even times where I'm like, I'm making up excuses not to do things because I feel like I have to be doing something for this. So like, you know, yesterday I was like, I didn't have anything to do, but like, I felt like I should be doing something. And I think there is like a balance to be struck with that, right? Yeah. Like we do have to be proactive and do things in order to grow an audience, in order to grow our passion. But like, it's a Sunday, you know, take advantage, like go to the beach. Don't like wait other people to get back to you in order to do stuff. Like you take it upon yourself to go out there and experience life, because because of our space and because of how we're consistently working like 24/7 during the week, you know, we need to take that time in order to just like disconnect. And it's kind of crazy, especially when you take a break from Twitter. I think Twitter is the worst. But like for me, I'm constantly on that thing. It's bad. It's really bad to the point where like people around me kind of, I mean, they pick up on it and they notice and they're like, hey, could you like not for like 5 minutes? And I'm like, well, like I have to, because it's like I'm in this space. So I don't know.
That's like this morning. Basically as part of what I've tried to do for the last, I don't know, 6 months, pretty much since I've been, maybe a year now, I try to not get on social media when I first wake up until I've planned my day, until I've thought through what do I want to do, not determined by other people's schedules. Like I actively avoid social media for a little bit. Yeah. And so today I did that for the first little bit. I was awake and I woke up late. I don't think my alarm went off, but then combined with the time change, like I woke up really late for me, only like, it was 8 a.m, but that was late for me. And I looked, and by the time I got to my phone 45 minutes later, I was like, wait, trailer. And so like, I feel like there's that FOMO, that fear of missing out is so much a part of what we're doing. But there's so much that happens on Twitter that's just energy draining and there's no gain to it. I pretty quickly, as soon as I went full time, I actively went I'm going to stop following these people. I know that they're actors, or I know that this is someone that I know in real life, or this, but there's people that just, they do things that just, they suck the energy away from me because my energy is just so locked in on trying to resolve whatever their crap is. And I can't resolve their crap.
Yeah.
And then there's the other side to it that I struggle with is trying to do the social media thing right, is then I turn into, you know, trying to document everything that I'm doing. And, you know, obviously I was out in California with you 6 months ago. And I just had okay, this is an adventure. That's part of the fun of my Instagram. And so then I have to have something to capture everything. And like, wait, guys, no, here, let me lean on this pier a little bit different.
and it's
doing all this stuff to like document your life. That's like, this is such a weird phenomena of the last few years that you know, you're not living the moment, you're trying to document the moment, and that's bad. And then the other one, final one, we should probably move on, but I touched on this on, or I posted about this on Twitter, a little incident that happened because of the dangers of social media and what can make it nasty. So I had a guy direct message me on Instagram, and it was like, "You're a prick. Your son is a total jerk and was so mean to my kid, and blank you in the movies, that, and just short, but like going off on me." And I almost roasted the guy instantly. And then I went, I should probably see if this is real. Let me try and play it out. Like I need to play responsible, because I know when someone wrongs my kid, my first reaction is to strike. And I'm mildly mature. So if this person is mildly less mature than me, then they'd be more strike first. Yeah. So what if it's real? And so then I tried to like do that. And this guy kind of went this whole narrative of losing his job and how my son was like, my dad's a YouTuber and he gets me stuff and takes me to do all sorts of cool things. And it was like, okay, this doesn't like sound totally like an adult, but it doesn't sound disconnected. There could be a truth inside of this. And so it's like, okay, so what's your son's name? I'll talk to my son afterwards. And I'll deal with this. If my son's being a jerk, I'll deal with him. Mm-hmm. And my son's name is this and this. And like, yeah, if you could tell me what you did to deal with your son, that'd be really good. Like, okay. And then I talked to my son. There's no George. I talked to my son's teacher. There's no George. I talked to people at Sunday school. There's no George. And then, so I was like, I'll just drop it. And then for the next 12 hours, this person kept messaging me every 3 hours, like, hey, have you punished your son yet? Hey, have you punished your son yet? Hey, have you punished your son yet? And so then I respond back, was this at school at North Oak? That is not the name of my son's school. The guy goes, yeah, that's right. And I go, and so I basically responded back, dude, you're lying. And I'm going to be in contact with the authorities. If you want to troll me, that's totally fine. That's cool. I'm an adult. You just targeted my son and this manipulative plan. And so then on Twitter, I was trying to find out if there's a way to report to the police or anything like that. And I don't know if there's any crime there. It falls into that just really gross middle zone where it is
in a way, it is harassment, right? Because his goal was to get you to punish my kid. Inflict harm on your child, which is, definitely falls under harassment.
Disturbing. Yeah. It's like, if you stop and play that one out of like anything this could have been, wants to do something that causes a wedge between me and my son. Like, what if I didn't have common sense and didn't ask his teacher and like verify the veracity of this and was like, dude, you were mean to something and you said this. Of course, I'd be an idiot if I did that. But what if I had done this and my son's like, I didn't do this thing. Like his way of trolling me is to do that. That is so disturbing.
It's
and
sick.
That's social it's media. Sick. It puts this detachment to where this person, I'm sure they're 14, 15 years old, they would never stand into my face and say any of that stuff. All this crap that people say to people over on the internet comment section, they'd never say it to my face. Most of them are probably 6 inches shorter than me and weigh 60 pounds less. They're just like skinny kid, little weird kids in their mom's basement trying to get their jollies. And they would never say it to my face. But that gap that the internet provides gives them confidence. And if you want to mess with me, whatever. It's weird, but I kind of get it. I was a kid once too. But the idea of actually for 12 hours straight going, did you do something to your son yet? Did you discipline your son yet?
It's following sick, up. Right?
It's disturbing.
I mean, it points to like a larger psychological issue that they probably have with their own parental relationships or relationship with their father or something like that. But it's just sick.
And that's kind of where I wonder if that's where some of this is coming from, is that's where the troll came from, is that they saw I'm doing weekly family fun nights.
Yeah, right.
And so then the person is just like, just lashing out at their own father by coming after me because I play video games with my son once a week or whatever, right. Take him to the movies and stuff. Cause it's like every piece of information he had about my son, it wasn't even my son's name. It was like, you take him to the movies. Like, okay, yeah, that's literally an Instagram post. You read my Instagram post with my son and then tried to use that against us as a family. Sick stuff. So
it really is, yeah.
Moving on to a more fun subject, the coronavirus is starting to have, what a segue.
Man. What a blast, man. That COVID topics. 2019.
So there was like a 1-2 punch last week of just really big pieces of news for what we do that are, as far as I know, pretty well unprecedented. So I believe was the first one, Bond, gets delayed?
The first one. Well, okay. So like there have been like a few cancel, like Ultra, a giant EDM festival. Miami was canceled. Rumblings of Coachella being canceled were kind of in the mix. And then, you know, obviously South by Southwest, one of the largest film festivals in the world and the country, was getting ready to have their festival end of this week, next week.
And people were pulling out left and right.
People were pulling out Google, Apple, Amazon.
So I guess I was Wednesday night. I was with one of my friends who was going to be at South by Southwest. You would have met him. And he acted in a movie that was playing at it. And the whole conversation we had was about how he was like nervous. Was like, I just want to see my movie.
Yeah.
And then as soon as we get out of the movie, I pull out my phone. Get a message from you guys actually saying Apple pulled out the, and I say, hey man, Apple pulled out of the film festival. He's like, what did they have? I was like, the Beastie Boys one. He's like, I wanted to see that.
Yeah, same. Yeah, I think I feel really bad for, and maybe this is jumping too far ahead, but I feel really bad for small independent films that really needed this platform in order to push their project. There are so many. This is the beauty of Film Fest. It offers filmmakers, like up and coming filmmakers, the opportunity to show their film off to the world, to get it in front of as many critics and journalists as possible, to spread positive word of mouth. I mean, there's a film that came out last year called Villains. I don't know. Did you see that film?
No.
With Micah Monroe and Pennywise, Bill Skarsgård. Small independent movie, got like a straight to VOD release, but a lot of positive word of mouth and buzz came out about it. And that's like a film that like you wouldn't have heard anything about had it not premiered at South by Southwest. And so like another example is the film Yes God, a movie that still has not gotten a theatrical release, but was a South by Southwest darling. A lot of people loved it. Zach Pope has been championing it. Filmmaker, it was an incredibly personal film to her, and it would not have gotten picked up by a distributor had it not been for South by Southwest. Yeah. So it's like, I feel really bad for those filmmakers that were relying on
Let's talk about
this.
South by Southwest before we get to Bond then.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I know we kind of jumped the gun. Like, it... I mean, you know, South by Southwest was canceled, and it not only has affected the Austin economy in such a negative way, because that's, I mean, I'm sure as you know, that at the city looks forward to that every year for just like this influx of you know, money and people coming in and whatnot. It's not just the festival. It's the stores, the restaurants. It's like, you know, whatever. And actually the fact that the festival was canceled this year because of how much money they're losing. They're not even sure if they can hold it next year. Like that's the situation we're in right now.
And that's where when people talk about, you know, the film festival was canceled, or South by Southwest was canceled, your first thought is, oh, an event didn't happen. And you go, oh, that's unfortunate. Cause you think about it from the perspective as an attendee, most of us perceive of things from what our experience is. And so, oh, an event didn't happen, but this isn't just like an event. This is like hundreds of thousands of people from all over the world coming to Austin for a music festival, a technology festival, and a film festival. And each one of those built into it is that it's an opportunity for things to be discovered. Yeah. All of those people coming from all over the country, that's a hotel room, that's an Airbnb, that's three restaurant meals per day, that's air travel. And so like the financial ramifications are massive, massive.
Yeah.
And then at for this, that wouldn't affect, this doesn't really affect me at all, but a lot of independent freelance movie pundits and movie critics, like, this is a huge part of the way that they make their money, is that they go to an event like this and then they write pieces for all these different outlets. And so then they take this huge hit that, like, this, I talk, you know, Black Widow. That's what I talk about on my channel. So I go to events like this because it's for networking and it's for me to enrich me as a film critic to have a deeper knowledge. But there's people that's where their money comes from. Like, that's, this is just, that's a huge hit. Filmmakers that like my buddy, this was his chance to see his movie on the big screen. Might not happen now. And it's just gigantic ramifications all going back to, you know, a virus, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, no, it was speaking to the freelancer part. That was the next thing I was going to bring up, was just the it's not just like the Austin economy that's going to hurt. Yeah. It's the journalists that have dumped so much money in order to have like their next month and the month after's rent paid for in order to have expendable income. I am in that sort of position, not to the extent of some other freelancers, but like, I was going to contribute and hopefully, you know, make some money off of pieces. I was going to conduct some interviews, potentially get money off of those and whatnot. And so, like, yeah, it is going at me for cash for the next couple of months. It is a pretty unfortunate thing. And now I'm just, like, trying to get as much money back as I can. Like, I know I talked about it at the top of the show, but, like, I have requested, like, a refund from American Airlines, and they're being so difficult. Like, Southwest, JetBlue, Delta, they've all given their people, like, their passengers or their tentative customers their money back, because what's happening is unprecedented, and American doesn't seem to want to address it. Unbelievable. You know, this kind of falls in that, like, emergency category of, well, you know, maybe we should show some just, you know, genuine human empathy and just refund these people. I mean, my God, it's not like it's going to cost them that much in the long run, but, like, good Lord. Anyways, a little bit of a tangent there, but yeah, no, it is, it's, and the effect that this has on the film industry in general, speaking that specific niche, because you're right, it is tech industry, it is, you know, keynote speakers, it is music festival, but just to our specific niche here, it is kind of an issue, and it kind of, you know, poses the question, what other festivals are going to be next?
Yeah.
Tribeca, Cannes. I can't imagine that Cannes is going to go forth, especially being in France. That has to be canceled, right?
I mean, that's what it feels like. It feels like this is only escalation of consequences and everyone tightening down. I mean, even right as we were about to start, something about Italy's tightening up their borders and stuff like that, to where
they've closed down all theaters in the country.
There you go. So
like, you know, Venice, that film festival, totally done unless the situation improves.
In which case, that's, you know, obviously Europe is a much, their countries are kind of in certain ways because of their vicinity to one another. That's much more congested space, to where you think that's almost certainly going to get shut down, and you get how crazy that is. And, you know, we're only beginning to see the ramifications for the movie industry. One of those being that the latest James Bond film was pushed back to the month of November. And I mean, in my video about it, I asked if anyone can think of an example of this, and all the examples people shot out were like, well, you know, this movie was shot back to do reshoots, and this one was supposed to, was like, no. That happens all the time.
Yeah.
Can you think of an example of a movie was postponed due to a health crisis? And that's, you know, that's what I said, that their reasoning was. And then there's just speculation, how much does it tie into the plot of the movie? Is it a pandemic? And so it's both, you know, they're more so, their box office is very a global type film or franchise. And so then it'll be hit heavier than a lot of Hollywood movies, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But also, if your movie's about a guy releasing a pandemic, bad timing.
Well, it's bad timing, but it's also kind of it speaks to how the Bond franchise usually has its finger on the pulse when it comes to, like, the geopolitical landscape, which I, one of the reasons why I love that franchise. But yeah, I mean, you know, you guys know me, massive Bond fan, absolutely gutted. When I first heard the news, I was a little pissed off, because, I mean, you know, South by Southwest hadn't been canceled. All these other things hadn't quite been figured out yet. And I was like, okay, this feels like a knee-jerk reaction, right? But when you look into it more and you see how much money, like, Spectre and Skyfall made in China, when you see how much money they made in Italy, the Bond is a global franchise, and it makes a good chunk of its money overseas. When you take that into account, it makes more sense for them to push the film back. They are taking about a $30 million loss, which is nothing to, like, you know, sniff your nose at. That's like a pretty significant loss, which they had to account for if they were going to move it. But yeah, I don't know. The funniest thing I saw from it was just seeing Cary Fukunaga's Instagram story and seeing his calendar, you know, after the No Time to Die release. Blank. I mean, it's just empty. The guy's gonna be playing like video games for the next 8 months. So.
Well, I just tried to think through all the little other hilarious ramification. Daniel Craig hosts Saturday Night Live 7 months early.
He was, well, just today the GQ released their like their most recent issue with him as like the front and center on the cover, doing like these shirtless pics and everything. Like, it's just, it's funny. It's kind of funny.
The funny part in a obviously terrible situation, but the other one I thought about as I did my previous video was that if you delay a movie by 7 months, a movie like this, that's seven more months of advertising.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that too. Yeah,
and movies like this—that's not cheap advertising. That, well, you know,
the budget for the film is $250 million without marketing. Like, they are going to be so far in the red by the time this film releases. They better pray that like people are going out to the theaters around Thanksgiving and earlier.
And they're banking that this is a Skyfall billion-dollar Bond film, and I mean that they're wanting it to be that. They need it to be that.
Yeah.
In which case, you know, if they're thinking we need to, for this to work, man, we need to push back 7 months and spend that much more marketing. That probably means you have to put out another trailer that's, man, that is huge, huge.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully they've only had one trailer, but like the amount of TV spots we've gotten have like slowly hit different parts of the plot. It's almost, it's really almost to the point where I don't want to see any new footage. Because they've given us the perfect amount, right? Like, they've been very vague, but they've, like, teased some of the stuff we can expect. And, you know, the hype was, like, everyone was really excited to go see this movie. And then you delay it for another 8 months. I mean, I feel bad for Billie Eilish. They dropped her song. Yeah. And now, like, you know, that's going to be out there in the ether for another 8 months. And they got to, like, drum up excitement for that again. And it's, like, it's not a great thing. But, like, understand why they moved it to November. Plus, it seemed like that's really what they wanted to do, like after all. Like, they knew the movie was earlier, like, way back before the coronavirus stuff. Like, they knew the movie was going to be finished in time for an April release, right? Yeah. But they, like, Bond traditionally releases in November. They really wanted to hit that release date. This kind of gave them an out. And, you know, everything we've heard from everybody involved with the film has been, like, overwhelmingly positive. Granted, there is bias because they're involved with the film, but, you know, a November release might point to some awards push, like, whether it be for Daniel Craig, Cary Fukunaga, Zimmer, Billie Eilish, you name it. It'll give them that platform to push. Plus, Thanksgiving holiday, there's nothing really coming out in December either. I think the movie's going to do really well at this slot because there's no Star Wars, there's no Marvel, there's no DC. It's going to own the box office for some time.
So, yeah. Unfortunate situation, but Bond November release, that's pretty traditional. So, it was almost kind of weird that they had it in April there for a little bit, but
yeah, I think they just didn't want to sit on it, honestly. Like, people have, like, it's been 5 years.
Yeah,
over 5 years since the last Bond film. I'm just, give me this thing. I'm ready for it.
So, with that said, we'll move on to kind of our final discussion of the day, talking about Pixar. We got a new Pixar movie this weekend, and it opened a little bit lackluster at the box office. And so, I just want to talk about why we think that is, things we love about Pixar, and then some of our Pixar recommendations. What do we, and you know, obviously everyone's seen Pixar, but a little discussion about some of our favorites. So Onward opens at 40 million. I believe Coco was 55 million. Inside Out opened at 90 million. Of course, Toy Story franchise movie was way above that. But even of kind of these standalone isolated ones, even, you know, Coco 15 million more. What's your theory as to kind of what's going on there with Onward? Because the reviews weren't too bad. Some people raving about it.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's disappointing to me because I love the movie. I think it's definitely one of Pixar's most mature films they put out to date, like right up there with Coco and Inside Out. I think it comes down to marketing. I really don't think it was marketed that well. People weren't really, I wasn't really feeling the excitement for it. Like, I got a press invite to go. I didn't feel it at all. I don't know if this happened to you, but I got a press invite to go see the film, and I was like, oh yeah, Onward, that's coming out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll go see it. But like, it just, yeah, I didn't feel the excitement from anyone. I mean, you know, I don't know if the coronavirus had anything to do with it. I really don't think it did. But, like, you know, there's, like, people not really wanting to go out in public. So maybe that paired with the fact that they weren't feeling, you know, the movie to begin with. So they're, like, definitely less inclined to go check it out.
Right. And it's that 1-2 punch of, it's not so much that people are like, oh, I'm paranoid, I'm not leaving my house. It's not the over-the-top version, but it's, if they're looking for any excuse to not leave the house, if there has a slight reservation and the movie just doesn't have anything that gives you that oomph to go, that's when it adds up, and it's like, just there's none of that upfront demand.
I completely agree. And, you know, you would think that, like, you know, Chris Pratt, Tom Holland would, like, pull in some people, but, like, they didn't. I don't know. I guess it ultimately didn't. It just kind of came down to the story, and people weren't really feeling it.
So, like the first trailer, it didn't feel Pixar. It just felt like any number of one of these random computer animated movies that any studio puts out. That's like a little bit of an adventure. Like, oh, look, mystical creatures. They're going on a road trip. It's the suburbs. That feels like what any studio does. And then when they got the second one that has a little bit more of that Pixar heart about, oh, it's about their dead dad. I mean, dad feels very Pixar. Yeah. But the way that it does it is like he's walking pants, which in its own way, it's like, huh? What?
Yeah.
And so you didn't, what the plot point of dead dad and wanting to see him, it's present in the trailers, but the actual emotion that you feel watching the movie, the way that as you experience it, actually seeing it and the way it's presented in the film, you connect with the characters and the sense of loss that they have. You watch the trailer and it's like, look, he's walking pants. And it just doesn't communicate it in the trailers what the experience of the movie is all that well.
Yeah, I also think that, like, you know, while critical reception was positive, it wasn't like overwhelmingly positive. Like, it was like, oh, this is a solid movie, but people weren't, like, you know, losing their minds over it, which I think also kind of contributed to it. And I think it's a hard movie to market. I think, you know, you double down on the fantasy adventure, unique world building aspects, and then sprinkle in some of the emotional elements. I think it just comes down to a concept in a film people really just didn't care about. You know, they didn't get it out there in front of as many people as it needed to. I mean, I don't know. They were like, they had, like, you know, early screenings for, like, the public, like through Fandango or whatever, like a couple of weeks before it came out. And, like, they were really trying, but ultimately it just kind of, it wound up short.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting one to me that, on the one hand, it's one of the more conventional of the Pixar plots because it is kind of road trip fantasy creature type stuff. So it's pretty straightforward in that regard. And then at the same time, it still has just enough of that weirdness in it that makes it tricky to have that hook. So it almost felt like it had the negative of both sides to that, of seeing just too much like something everybody does and at the same time a little bit too weird. Whereas when Pixar just kind of goes full weird, look, talking emotions, people know, oh, powerful Pixar movie.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, this one wasn't able to work. But I guess with that said, What are the things that get you excited when you think Pixar? Obviously, great reputation, have done some pretty fantastic things over the years. What is it to you that gets you most excited about Pixar movies?
Originality, truthfully, because I think they've come up, you know, while they have kind of like rested on their laurels a little bit and done more sequels than I would have liked, as of late, I do think, you know, when they hit that mark, and I'll even include Onward in that, when they do hit that mark with original concepts, you get something that's unlike any other animated film, you know, out there, really. And so like, that's always what gets me excited. It's like the original concept mixed with like genius writing, mixed with like the emotionality. It's just a thing that's built for everyone. It doesn't cater too much towards kids, doesn't cater too much towards adults. Like, there's stuff in there. It's like a universal film, which is, you don't get that a whole lot. And so that's what always gets me excited for Pixar films. Oh, on top of that, just like the cutting edge, breathtaking animation that has legitimately only gotten better with each entry. It's still astonishing. I remember I don't know about you, but I remember the first time I saw The Good Dinosaur, just like water has never looked
the water
clear.
Specifically, like very cartoony dinosaur, and then the water, you're like, wow.
Yeah,
I know that's
right?
Animated, but wow.
Yeah, yeah. Or like the fabrics on Mr. Incredible's shirt in The Incredible 2. It's just
right. Essentially the same answer for me, that they're able to take these very original, bizarre concepts at times. I mean, some of them are truly bizarre. And then they infuse them with just so much humanity and relatability. And then they create a product that my, at the time, 4-year-old, at the time, 3-year-old children were able to enjoy, have fun with, want to watch on loop. And then it's also just a really good movie for adults.
Yeah.
That to me is something that's really, like, that's next level storytelling when you're able to have such broad appeal, have something to say about the human experience. It's entertaining. Uh-huh. That's, and doing it with a non-obvious story.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable.
Well, dare I say that Pixar represents, to me, more of what Disney has traditionally been about, more so than Disney does as a company right now. Like, I get they're part of Disney, but, like, Pixar, to me, really feels like they are, like, that's the heart of Disney right now. Like, you look at their other properties, I'm not getting that stuff with Frozen 2, I'm not getting that stuff. You know, whatever, like, nth sequel or live action remake they're coming out with right now. Pixar is truly the only division that has maintained the philosophy that Disney has kind of set forth. And like, they make you feel young again while speaking to you, like, where you're at in your current point in time, which is just, it's a remarkable that they're able to do something like that.
Yeah. And that's, I think it's also what makes a movie like Cars 2 just seem so obscenely out of place.
It's so weird.
And some people like grew up on the Cars movies, and so they're like, oh man, I loved Cars 2. It's so fun and funny. Made it. Or they have some reason. but like when you take that movie, came out just like 3 years, 4 years after Wall-E, Ratatouille, Up. And you're like, what? While you guys were like putting in theaters Up, you were like, and what if Mater's a spy? Like, and so that's what makes some of those ones feel so out of place. And likewise, I was extraordinarily vocal about not being excited about Toy Story 4. And I loved Toy Story 4 when I saw it.
Yeah.
And so afterwards, I had a certain percentage of people trying to do it, and I told you so to me. Like, I told you so. Like, it was a lot better than you thought it was going to be. Like, do you take back everything you said? Like, I don't take back a single word that I said. I was wrong about this one movie, but my argument was, one, Pixar is at its best and most interesting when it's telling these original stories. That's what gets me most excited.
Yeah.
Even when, like, Onward, I was more – I was positive but more lukewarm than you were. But it's an original thing. That's still more exciting to me than, like, but do you want a Toy Story 5?
Exactly. No, because same boat as you. I thought the idea of a Toy Story 4 was absolutely absurd. I was like, how could you possibly, like, even though I'm not the biggest fan of Toy Story 3, how could you possibly create a sequel to that that delivers on the emotions and concludes the franchise in a way that is fulfilling, and yet they did it.
And they found that angle that we missed. They saw the thing that we didn't see. It was like, okay, first 10 minutes, I see what you're doing here. That makes sense. Gotcha. Yep. Go. And I was on board.
And I think it is.
But the trailers didn't sell that. I think that's and that's the other reason I was like, I stand by what I said before, because the thing that hooked me in the first 10 minutes wasn't really in the trailers. They were like, mm-hmm. there's a fork who's having an existential crisis like, okay, we're getting lost again. We've done that before. Why are we telling this story? Oh, the whole point is that this franchise or this trilogy over here was about their relationship with Andy and Woody's relationship as the leader of Andy's tribe.
Yeah.
And that's different over here in this new family. That makes total sense to why he would have one more story to be told about him. And that's not in the trailers. That's once again why I was like, I stand by what I said, because what they sold to me messed the thing that made the movie work and justified its existence. It's not in the trailers. And no matter what, even if they had done that, what gets me excited about Pixar is when they're telling these weird original things. Soul. Like, my first instinct isn't like, I don't know how I'll feel about it once I see it. There's things about it where I'm like, that doesn't totally resonate with me. And then but more importantly though, than all of that is I go, I love it when Pixar does this.
Yes.
Like a weird movie for kids about jazz music in the afterlife.
Yeah.
What is that?
I don't know.
Who
can do that except
Pixar? Agree. Yeah, who would do that? No one, except Pixar.
Yeah, no, I'm in the same boat. And, like, you know, with Toy Story 4, I was so happy to be proven wrong. Like,
right, exactly.
I completely agree with you. I still maintain the beliefs going into that, because nothing they advertised or teased, like, you know, led me to believe that this was necessary. But I saw the film. I was absolutely able to be proven wrong. In fact, it genuinely might be my favorite out of the entire series.
I currently have it as my number one.
And I
don't know a year from now when I rewatch that. I don't, you know, that could shift around. But I was pretty confident because I just rewatched all the Toy Story movies. Then I watched the fourth one and I went, this one has just it is just as much emotion, and it tackles some of these nostalgia, growing up, moving on in a new and different way. And I think it's safe to say it's the funniest of the bunch.
Oh, I was just about to say, I think it's absolutely hysterical. Like, I haven't laughed that hard in a Toy Story film since the first one, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, like, yeah, I know, I completely agree with you. I definitely prefer it when Pixar is doing, like, these just bold and ambitious things, like, with Inside Out and now with Soul. Like, that excites me more than, like, I don't know, like Wall-E 5 or whatever, you know, like,
so I've had this weird thing over the last week where I've had a bunch of people asking me, like, which Pixar movie do you want a sequel to? And I'm like, that's not what I want.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Oh, I had another guy that asked me, and I don't mean to pick on these people, but because my passion for Pixar is so much originals, that's why these questions came off odd to me. So I'm not trying, you happen to ask me, I don't mean to pick on you. Another guy was like, so with all of these remakes of past movies happening, which movie would you want Pixar to remake? And I was like, and I tried to think about it. Like, I know what you're asking. Like, what movie that was live action? I think that's what they want, a live action to Pixar. And so, like, there's an interesting thing in the question, but my thought is just so much. What they do so well is some bonkers spin on some idea.
Yeah.
With so much humanity, so much heart. That's what I love about Pixar. So the idea of them picking up and, like, what if we did The Burbs Pixar?
Yeah.
Like I hear that and I just go, that it fundamentally misses what excites me about Pixar.
Right. Or, like, vice versa, you know, with Disney doing live action remakes. Like, if they were to do, like, an Incredibles live action, you would miss so much. Like, people don't realize how much, like, the art style and the time period plays into the identity of the Incredibles. Like, that is, like, 50s retro future to a T. And it is it perfectly plays into just like everything that's going on with the Incredibles, like this the 60s sort of James Bond elements mixed with like the superhero craze at comic books at the time. If you translate that to a live action, you miss all of that. And so like, and that's, you know, going a little bit on a tangent here, but that's why I don't, that's why I fundamentally disagree with a lot of these decisions to do like live action remakes. Yeah. You know, The Lion King is a perfect example. Like you miss literally all of the emotion and color and impact of that film by doing it in a live action format. You just, it has no identity at that point.
Right, right. So to close things out, I thought, why don't we say kind of our favorite Pixar films as well as which ones aren't necessarily our favorite, but which one means the most to us? Which one is the one that makes us go, that makes me love Pixar, that they create movies like this. So I put out my Pixar ranking just a couple days ago. What's your favorite Pixar movie?
Yeah, well, actually, before I go into that, I didn't watch your ranking. Go ahead, everyone, yell at me in the comments. I'm sorry.
How dare you?
I know. How rude of me. I'm actually curious. What was your favorite before I go into it?
So number one on my ranking, and it has been, I think, as long as I've been doing these rankings, is actually Finding Nemo.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So
I
didn't watch it until 10 years after it came out. And my son was like a year old or something like that. We put it on. And it's a movie that you watch very differently if you're watching it as a parent for the first time. And the opening scene is mass death. And, you know, the whole process of parenting is letting go. And so when you're a year in, you've been in this paranoid state of like, my baby can die from anything. Because every article you read is another way that you could kill your baby.
Right.
And then you have a movie where in the first 10 minutes, the all but one are killed.
Yeah.
And the wife is killed. And so that it's just learning to kind of let go. So right at the right moment in time, I watched it for the first time and thought it, you know, funny, so many memorable lines. And then it just kind of has this very powerful message throughout it that's really about parenting more than being a child. And so that one's been the one that was – on my rankings, that's the number one on my rankings.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that is that's a good point. I actually haven't watched. I mean, granted, I don't have kids. I'm not a parent or whatever. But like, that is one I haven't watched in a while. So I'm wondering like if it'll hit me in a different sort of way. Yeah. But no, similar to you. I mean, ever since I saw the dang film, The Incredibles has been my number one since 2004. I mean, that's one of my favorite films of all time, if I'm being honest. It's like, as I was kind of talking about before with like the style, the 50s, 60s sort of retro futurism with like the James Bond spy elements, Brad Bird's direction, the voice acting, just like the identity that film has, how fun and exciting it is while telling a very compelling story about family and acceptance and being unashamed of who you are and whatnot. I just, that movie is so good. Every time I rewatch it, I'm consistently blown away with how, like, arguably more so than most of Pixar's films, like, it is universally for everyone. It gives you that, like, Saturday morning kind of like cartoon, like action adventure for the kids, but then it's got like it's got some like pretty intense violence in it for like the adults. There's like, you know, Mr. Incredible maybe is having an affair or not, you know, he's there drinking mimosas on a plane. So it's like it is mature enough but without going over the line that it's such a blast, and it's truly a film for everyone. In terms of deep cuts, that's really tough. Because like I would be inclined to go with like Ratatouille or something like that, but a lot of people people love that film.
Anyone you pick, it's going to be a deep cut or going to be a deep cut because they're all hits in their own right. So, but that I think that's a great example of a movie that, if you describe it, there's a rat that's seeing ghosts and he wants to be a chef, and therefore he's like controlling a guy, remote control. Yeah. But that's what makes Pixar so crazy, is that they can make that a very relatable story.
I agree. And truthfully, Ratatouille might be my second favorite one, but I know a lot of people like that, so I won't go with that one, and I'll kind of move away from Brad Bird, because I just, if you look at my top 10 Pixar, it's like The Incredibles, Ratatouille, The Incredibles 2. So it's like, you know, I really like when Brad Bird is in this, but you know, not a lot of people talk about The Good Dinosaur, and like, I understand why. I just think, you know, I still think it delivered on the emotions while being a fun sort of like Western-ish adventure, and like I enjoyed the animation, I enjoyed like the characters, and like the story they said. It's not like it's not gonna blow your mind or knock you out of the park, or like it's not a knock out of the park or whatever, but like it is enjoyable, it's emotional, I think it's arguably the most beautiful looking Pixar movie out of the bunch. Aside from that, I guess my next one would be like Monsters University. That's just a fun movie, to be honest. I think it gets a little people crap on that movie a little too much, in my opinion. So I think it's fun. It's simple. It's sweet. It's not trying to do anything ambitious like the first one, but it really just like it's a nice little prequel. So,
yeah, for me, the one that comes to mind, if I think what's like a movie that when I think. A Pixar movie that for me specifically is like wowed with what they were able to do with it. I didn't normally go to Inside Out.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So
I
was an education major, so took classes on cognitive development and stuff like that, and had some write some papers on things like that. And so then, as you're going through the story, and it's attempting to take these a lot of what you learn about is how children are concrete thinkers, and you start to become an abstract thinker when you're 13 years old around that puberty time frame. Mm-hmm. And so there's these concepts that both they don't understand because their brain hasn't developed. And the movie is communicating those concepts to children, yeah. Which it's like, whoa, that's really smart what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And it's even like you're addressing the thing that you're communicating in the communication itself. And it's just that they could turn that into like a classic Pixar, two opposites get lost and have to get back home while doing such inventive stuff. And they walk into a room and it's like, here's the abstract phase and here's the con. And I just loved all that sorts of stuff. And they're looking at dreams and they're all kinds of different things and helping kids understand their emotions and, more pre-puberty, but a little bit of touching on some of that stuff that just just really neat what they were able to do, and so mainstream at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's in terms of just their most ambitious and arguably like most impressive feat. Yeah, I would go with that one for sure, and it definitely hits those emotional levels. I am curious, so what is your hottest Pixar take, like a take that like people are gonna like really scratch their heads about when you say it.
The two things that in my rankings over the last couple of years that I've gotten the most heat for, number one is that initially I had Incredibles 2 over Incredibles, and I still stand by that Screen Slaver is a better villain than Syndrome. I've never been a Syndrome fan. I've always been like, I don't buy into you got shunned once and therefore I'm not tracking it with you. Too far, man. Too far. It's one of those plot tropes that I don't think worked in Iron Man 3 or it didn't work great in Iron Man 3, Amazing Spider-Man 2, or Batman Forever. They've all kind of done that kind of – the hero was mean to this guy once, and now it never fully works for me. Yeah, and so that's one that I always have gotten a bunch of crap for. And then the other one is that I have like Coco at number 13, 14 on my list. But every time I've done that, like what I say in the video is like, okay, we're about to transition here. And everything after this point in time, I think is very good. These are all movies I gave like a B+ or higher. So don't hate me. I'm not crapping on Coco. I have no issues with this movie. It is none of those things. But next up is Coco, and then people are like, why do you hate Coco so much? Yeah. This movie meant so much to me. This is like my family dynamics. This is what I grew up with, and I just cannot believe that you didn't like – I gave it a B+. Pixar has just made a lot of great movies. And that's the problem I have with every single one of these Pixar rankings. When you have a studio that – I mean, if you just look at the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, how many movies they have over 90%. Yeah. Over 90%, not just fresh, over 90%, you get yourself in trouble.
Yeah, yeah, no, that is interesting. I get where you're coming from with the Coco thing, because I don't think that makes my top 10 either. And you know what? That's okay, because I'm glad the people right. that it resonates with, like, can champion and get excited about that movie. That's what I love about Pixar. They're making films for everyone, but, like, obviously certain films are going to hit certain demographics of people, like, more. So, like, I'm glad the film exists, but just because it's not my top 10 doesn't make it a bad movie, you know? So... whatever, but I think my hottest Pixar take, and I've always actually maintained this ever since I saw it. I don't like Up. I outside of the first 5 minutes of Up, I don't think it's that great of a movie. I think it's like very okay, and the rest of the film never reaches the heights of that first 5 minutes. I mean, you know, every time people talk about Up, they're only talking about like the opening kind of married life sequence, and I honestly think it would have been better as a short film than a theatrical feature.
All right. With that said, where can we find you on the internet?
Yeah, you guys can find me over on the Film Speak channel. Hopefully we'll have some reviews out this week for Bloodshot. I know everyone's thrilled about that. And The Hunt. So, yeah, you guys can check out my channel over there for movie reviews, podcasts, interviews, all that good stuff. And then you can give me a follow on Twitter at Griff Schiller.
If you're wondering why I put a phone to my face at the end of this for those of you watching on YouTube, it's because our internet went wacky, so we've been having to cut back and forth to try and make this work. So we're finishing things out using my phone. Anyway, thank you guys so much for watching. Be sure to tell me if you're on YouTube what you think down below in the comment section. If you're listening on your favorite audio format, podcast, template, go ahead and leave a review, a rating, all of that fun stuff. Griffin, thank you so much for joining me, and everyone, keep watching movies too much.